Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We celebrate the birth of the American Wilderness System. And guess what? We get all the presents. Our land, for us, millions of acres. But how did it happen? Why did we do it? And what do we look forward to into the future of wilderness? When we return, that's what we focus on with Dr. Rod Nash on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I am honored that we have as our guest today a man who is recognized as America's foremost wilderness historian. Professor Roderick Nash is best known for Wilderness and the American Mind, published by Yale University Press, and The Rights of Nature, published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Dr. Nash, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney. Pleasure to be on here and to be thinking about the 40th anniversary of the Wilderness Act.
Dr. Nash, how is it that wilderness became such a part of your life?
I grew up in New York City looking at brick walls and wondering if there would ever be an opportunity to be a Lewis and Clark, or my distant ancestor was Simon Roderick Fraser, the discoverer of the Fraser River. And I thought about that, and I thought, coming out of that environment, maybe I could get into the West. Maybe I could start exploring some of the wilderness that was there, and began to run wild rivers, began to shape a career as a river guide, ultimately kind of fixed on the Grand Canyon, which a lot of people do. Everybody sort of drifts to there eventually, and this is a magnificent two-week trip through the desert wilderness. And I've done that over 50 times, both as a professional guide and independently. So that was kind of my outlet from New York City, and I decided, I might as well write if I'm going to be a scholar about something in which I'm interested, and there it was. Let's think about wilderness.
Was there ever a moment that stands out in your mind when the concept of wilderness began to emerge?
You know, there was a time when I was 11 years old, and I was at a boys' camp in the West. I walked across the Grand Canyon, 22 miles, and I remember looking out at that landscape and thinking to myself that 90% of it no one had ever been on, no one had ever stood on, no one had ever seen. You're talking vertical walls here, cliffs, canyons. And I remember that being an overwhelming idea to me, thinking, you know, the world is still new. The world is unexplored here. I could maybe be part of this place. And I guess it was about that time I began to think a little bit about what wilderness means. And I suppose the ultimate meaning of wilderness is a place where human beings have never visited at all.
So you began a quest to understand this concept of wilderness, a quest that has led to a lifetime of writing, teaching about, and celebrating wilderness. Tell us about that journey.
One of the things that I realized was that we've experienced an intellectual revolution, and wilderness began as a hated, feared, dark presence. The early herding and agriculturalists who began to control nature looked upon the wild, upon wilderness, as something to be feared and controlled and resisted. And so for thousands of years, we had this bias against wilderness. It was a liability. The transformation in the last 200 or 300 years, just one of the great intellectual revolutions, one of the great changes in the history of ideas about nature. And that was what fascinated me, was how could you go from something that was loathsome in the minds of civilized people to something that civilized people not only valued but wanted to preserve in acts like the Wilderness Act of 1964.
What were some of the seeds of that transformation?
The seeds are what I detail in Wilderness and the American Mind, the book, and they range from the arts and letters, both of which in the 19th century, in the American context, began to look at wilderness as something unique, something different, something we had that other nations didn't have, something that was beautiful, in a sense of being awesome, in a sense of being sublime. They were sort of new aesthetic categories that entered the vocabulary. Perhaps the most important one, though, was to look at the end of the 19th century at what we call the ending of the frontier, where the U.S. Census said no more frontier. It was about that time in American development that we began to think we were away from our youthful origins, that we had largely settled the continent, and that we could look back nostalgically on our past. And when we look back to our past, what did we find? We found the frontier, we found wilderness, we found pioneers. And people at that time began to say, wilderness may be important as an historical document. We're not going to learn about the history of our country on freeways and shopping malls and in cities. We're going to learn about it in wilderness areas and national parks. And maybe we shouldn't completely exterminate the buffalo. And maybe we should allow Native American people to adopt their own ways and have some freedom and not completely conquer and have dominion. That's a big turning point. 1890s, early 20th century, the beginning of concern for protecting the older, wilder, historical American environment.
And then, of course, the 20th century began an era of technological expansion, increased power, the power to transform whole landscapes and to tear down mountains. And I think that also had an effect, that through time it helped us to realize that there were limits on this process.
Very, very, very much the case, Sidney. You know, the wilderness appreciation is a product of civilization. The Sierra Club came out of San Francisco. The Appalachian Mountain Club came out of New York. This idea that the intensifying of civilization is a process that increases the value of wilderness is very basic. As wilderness became more scarce, it became more valuable. As civilization became more successful, it became ironic. People began to realize, hey, there are liabilities to these big cities. Maybe we need a place where we can go out and worship, where we can go out and breathe clean air, where we can go out and see something of the American past. And that was where wilderness came to have value. So you've got to look at this as civilization rises in intensity, wilderness increases in value.
So about the 50s and 60s, as these movements began, actually individuals began to give voice to this concept of wilderness, and people once again paid attention. Tell us about some of those voices that began to help define what we are now talking about as wilderness.
I think one of the most important voices, someone I wrote about in both the Wilderness book and the History of Environmental Ethics book, The Rights of Nature, was Aldo Leopold. Aldo Leopold was born in 1886. He became one of the nation's first ecologists. He became one of the first people to be aware that there were interconnections in nature and that wildness held wisdom and keys that scientists should understand. Leopold, in the Forest Service, began a policy of urging that large roadless areas be inventoried and set aside. He went on to become a professor at the University of Wisconsin. In fact, when I was a student there, I worked in some of his archives and papers, and it was a great privilege to go back and look at this man's mind as he began to think. In the context, say, of the Great Depression, when a lot of people weren't thinking about wilderness, he began to think about its importance and about systematic preservation. But his book, A Sand County Almanac, which was pretty much ignored after its publication in 1949, went on to become something of a classic and a huge seller in the 1960s, and was, I think, definitely behind the thinking of the political figures and the organizational people like Howard Zonheiser who pushed the act through. So Leopold, very important in that. And I would also add another historical figure, Henry David Thoreau and John Muir, as very important to the people who rallied around the Wilderness Act concept.
So as the Wilderness Act began to be considered, what was the discussion then?
In the early discussions of the Wilderness Act, going back to the big victory of 1956 over the proposed Echo Park Dam and Dinosaur National Monument, it was that victory in keeping the dam out of the national park. This decision in 1956 was one that encouraged wilderness advocates. After that battle, they said, well, why can't we now move ahead more aggressively and not just be defensive, not just defend threats to national parks and wild country? Why can't we go on the offensive and create a system that protects this land before it's threatened? And that, I think, was the genius of the Wilderness Act. And I would add, Sidney, that as we think about the Wilderness Act, we've got to realize it was the world's first systematic, specific, legal institutional protection of wilderness in world history. This is one of the best ideas our culture ever had, along with the national park idea. This September 3rd, 1964 piece of legislation was a pathbreaking, and we have been widely admired for it.
And now here we are 40 years later. Certainly at that time, in the 60s, this concept of nature was primary. For a while, the wilderness and nature seemed to be very mainstream and dear, and it was part of an American ethos that we valued. And even through time, through the next 40 years, something has begun to change, and that's why I feel that wilderness at 40 today and then tomorrow is really so critical, because the concept of wilderness is changing. What is the significance of wilderness as we look out another 40 and 400 and perhaps 4,000 years?
Good questions. When the Wilderness Act was passed in 1964, most of the valuation of wilderness was what I call anthropocentric. That it was the center around human values, recreation, scenery. The economics of nature tourism, for example, were all primary. But gradually over time, we began to see a spiritual and an ethical dimension creep into the defense of wilderness. One would look at the Endangered Species Act of 1972 and see that as marking a real sea change in our attitude toward nature around us, that we should be members and not masters of the life community. With that kind of environmental ethic thinking, that nature had rights that human beings ought to respect, you look at wilderness as someone else's home. By someone else's home, I mean another species' home. You remember the quote in the Act is, a place where man is a visitor who does not remain. Well, that implies that it's not our home and that it is somebody else's home, and we should go in there with certain rules and certain behavioral patterns that carry out that respect. We're the world's most dangerous species, and when we set aside wilderness, we exercise a very badly needed gesture of self-restraint. And a wilderness as restraint, wilderness as a place where we back off and take a time out and allow processes and other species to have a fair share of their space, to me is a huge frontier of significance for wilderness. I believe in another 40 or 400 years, we will look at the value of wild country primarily from an ethical and a spiritual concept. Wilderness is valuable even if we never go to it, even if we never enter it. And in a sense, wilderness, designated wilderness, is not for us at all. I believe there's a real argument that says it is for the other 60 or 90 million or so species on this planet and the processes that have preceded us and hopefully go on beyond us.
Very well said. If you were talking to someone and they'd never been to a wilderness, what is it that you could give to them? What is it that they might gain that they could understand about the wilderness from the outside?
Very good question. The main characteristic of wilderness is it's a place that civilized human beings do not control. And that means that visitors need to be self-reliant in wilderness. And the common support net that we find under us in civilization is gone. And to some, that's very exciting and very important. To others, it can be very scary. If you've never been to wilderness, it's something you need to think about. It's something that many of us who have lived before the era of cell phones and GPS are wondering about a little. Is there an argument that there should be experiences and places where it's cell phone free? I think from some standpoint, a sat phone or a cell phone changes the experience in wilderness just as much as does a motorbike.
Now, I know you've done some thinking about the world without wilderness. What are your thoughts?
I have thought about the future, and by that I'm pushing things out maybe 1,000 years as to what our relationship with nature will be. One scenario in the future is that we've trashed the planet, maybe extinguished ourselves, maybe moved on to another planet and are repeating the process, the ultimate of ingratitude, and that would kind of be the wasteland scenario. There's another scenario, though, and that is, what if we destroyed the last vestiges of wilderness on this planet by means of turning the earth into a garden? And if we modified nature to that extent, we might have a beautiful and productive planet, but it would not be a wild planet. And what would be lost here? One thing would be many high percentage of the species that live in the wild places on Earth. Another thing that would be lost would be the wilderness experience. We would be wandering through a garden. I think that the power of technology is going to continue to increase, and I think with that is going to come increase in the power to modify nature. And that might be used beneficently to create a vast garden, but I, for one, would regret that process and would hope that we would develop the moral restraint to back off and say, we're not going to complete this task, even if we could.
That's very progressive thinking. So as we look at wilderness in this celebration year, what are you looking at celebrating?
Well, you know, what I'm particularly interested in, and I'm an advisory board member of a group called Wilderness Watch, and one of the things we're interested in here is that even though we have a Wilderness Act on the books, there seems to be a tendency to chip away at the edges of the concept and to dilute the act and to make variations in the act and to allow certain things that I don't believe are appropriate in wilderness. I believe the integrity of the wilderness system depends upon watchdogging this original 1964 act, just like the Supreme Court watches over our Constitution. And I think we need to exercise a similar vigilance on our protection of wilderness, or we're going to find it eroding and eroding and eroding, and pretty soon there'll be so many exceptions that we will find ourselves without wilderness and without its values.
Professor Nash, I want to thank you so much for sharing your spirit and thoughts here on the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney, for recognizing the importance of this 40th anniversary of the Wilderness Act.